Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. And if you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener Podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Now let's get growing. Bonjour, and welcome to episode 170 of the Organic Gardener Podcast today. And I am just thrilled to introduce my guest because not only are you going to love listening to him, but we are about to break 250,000 downloads of the Organic Gardener Podcast. Yes, thanks to all of you amazing green future growers listening out there. That's 250,000 downloads, very likely just as we are speaking this morning. It's January 12th, 2017. And way back in episode 45 of the Organic Gardener Podcast, Joyce Pinson recommended the award-winning book, The Market Farmer, The Market Farmer by Jean-Martin Fortier, who is revolutionizing the way we think about agriculture, small-scale farming, and most of all, how we care for our planet. And today he's here with us to share his knowledge and his incredible passion. So I know you are going to be as excited as I am to hear him speak. So welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm super happy to be with you. Oh, wow, this is exciting.
It's so exciting. So because I'm just about to have my two-year anniversary and to my podcast is just growing and doing really well because of my wonderful guests like you and Joyce, and because of my super listeners. I call them the green future growers because not only are they gardeners, but they're growing a greener future for all of us. So, So welcome to the show and tell listeners a little bit about yourself.
Well, okay. Well, I'm French Canadian. So I live in Quebec, Canada, and I have a micro farm with my wife that we've been farming there for almost 15 years, and it's a really special farm with regards to the fact that it's kind of big and small. So it's a small commercial farm compared to other CSA or vegetable production farms. We cultivate about an acre and a half. So that's about the size of a soccer field. But by using the techniques and tools that we use, we're able to generate enough income for my wife and I to be living from that acre and a half. And we feed more than 250 families. We do a CSA, and we go to two farmers market, and we do specialty crops like salad mix for certain restaurants and for the local grocery store in our community. And so the farm has been in an operation for a while, and I guess if I can say it that way, I guess that my claim to fame is that we've been proving that a farm doesn't need to be big to be very profitable, and that you can use hand tools and low-tech gardening strategies to grow commercially and make it happen for yourself, all while feeding the community with nourishing food. So I don't know. That's kind of an intro.
I think that's a perfect introduction. So your farm, I don't know how to say it in French, but I've tried to learn French for years, but I really struggle with speaking it at all. But and it's named after the Broad Fork. Is that right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Broad Fork. I'm sure your listeners know what the Broad Fork is. It's a tool that it's a big tine that you plunge into the ground, and then with the rowing motion, you just kind of loosen up your soil, but you don't disturb the ecology, and you don't flip it upside down, which is really what you want to do. And so we call our farm Broad Fork Farm, but actually it's not called the Broad Fork Farm because the Broad Fork originates in France. There's a guy named André Grenet who invented it in the early 60s, and so he called it La Grelinette, and our farm is called Les Jardins de la Grelinette, which means the gardens of the Broad Fork.
Okay, and I am going to really encourage listeners, I put the links in my show notes, to go, if they don't know what a Broad Fork is or they haven't seen it, to go to your website and see what it looks like. Because I had never heard of it until I started my podcast, and people had talked about it. I couldn't really envision it until we had a seed fair last April, and somebody brought one in, and that's when I was like, oh, we've got to get one of those. So I think that's really interesting. And then the other thing I was going to tell people also is there's some really cool YouTube videos of your farm, and I was watching. I just have learned so much. Just even this morning watching, I was watching Curtis Stone do some interviews on your farm and walking around. And I love the little insect hotel and the way you wash the vegetables. And there's just so much that you have to teach people. So I'm going to be quiet, but I do always like to kind of start out the show asking about your very first gardening experience. You know, were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, did your parents garden, or where was your first gardening experience?
Okay. So I grew up in the suburbs, like a typical teenager, skateboarding, snowboarding. My parents were not hippies. My parents were not farmers. My father had a small garden. I don't remember it being something that was so important, but he did have a garden. But my first memory of the garden was in the garage. There was some shelves that had these bottles in them. And these were bottles with, you know, bones, and it was like extreme danger, and this was the pesticide cabinet.
Oh.
And as a young guy, I was really curious about the pesticide cabinet, and I would look at these bottles and you know, that was one of my first memory of the garden. and I don't know, funny enough, I grew up to really understand that this is really nasty stuff, and I can't even imagine why a home gardener would put poison in his garden. Like, I think that this is like when people used to smoke in hospitals and in airplanes and cars. So that's one of my first memories. And my father used to grow roses, so it wasn't in the garden. He would have some tomatoes, but he would always take care of his roses. And I don't know, perhaps that's why I called my daughter Rose.
Aw, I have a daughter whose middle name is Rose too. You know, I used to wonder that all the time. It's interesting because the first person who mentioned the broad fork on my show, she worked on a farm, and the other woman who worked on her farm, I interviewed her father, and he was telling me that when they were kids, when his dad came home and pesticides first came out, everybody was all excited about it. It was like the new technology, like, oh, you're not going to have to weed anymore. And, you know, just the information wasn't out there. So I kind of started to understand a little more that, you know, it was just kind of a lack of knowledge. But yeah, it's always like, I can't imagine putting pesticides on my food. And I still laugh today when people tell me that they do things like that, because there's still lots of people out there that just, they just don't even know. They go to the store and they see it on the shelf and they think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that if they're listening to your podcast, it's because they're frankly quite aware of that. You should be careful about what you eat, because when people don't care about what you eat, they only care about how much money they'll make doing it. It is really, really easy to spread a lot of nasty stuff on it and not have anyone know about it.
My husband just sent me an article yesterday about the pesticides that they're putting on wheat. And like, it was like they're putting it on the wheat after they've right before they're harvesting or something, to because it's like gentler on the machinery. It doesn't even have to do with like killing bugs or anything, but something about, I can't remember what it was, but it's just amazing sometimes the pesticides people are using that and that we're eating that people don't know. And yeah, the people who listen to my podcast probably are, but you know, when you run into people like on an everyday basis, people who don't listen to my podcast, I think I'm still surprised. Or like, I'll ask people to be a guest on my show because I just assume everybody's organic. And then when they write me back and they're like, well, I'm not organic or I'm not earth friendly and I use, you know, all these different things. They're like, why is that bad? And I'll be like, well, you know, there's other options out there. And yeah, you probably shouldn't put that on your food. So I read in your book you learned how to garden organically, but do you want to tell listeners?
Yeah, I met my wife at university. We were studying ecology and environment, and basically we were studying how, you know, it's I don't want to say gloom and doom, but we were looking at how all the natural systems are being replaced by deforestations and all these other problems. And we were, frankly, after 3 years, we were kind of like, we need to be doing something that is going to help the world. And I still feel strong about that now, but we were looking for how to do that. And so we took a trip. We went to Mexico. We worked on coffee bean farms or fair trade coffee farms. We looked at that. Then we came up to the U.S. and we started to work building earthships, which are super cool houses, independent houses in the desert of New Mexico, built out of recycled tires, recycled cans, all off the grid. So we worked there for a little while, found that that was interesting too. Then we started to woof, which is the volunteer on a small organic farm around Santa Fe, New Mexico. That's where we met with Richard Bélanger, which was an expat. So he was, it's funny, he was a French Canadian that had been farming and living in Santa Fe for a long time, for more than 10 years. And he was the salad king at the Santa Fe farmers market. Everybody knew who Richard was. He was one of the better growers. And he was in my young mind, he was a local hero because people would line up at his booth and pay him for his product. And he was making good money at Saturday's farmer's market because we were helping him with his cash box. And he was happy because he was speaking French with us. So we had a special bond. And then the neighbor at the farmer's market, they had a Montessori school, and they had a farm manager that was running a 1.5 acre farm there for them. And he left in August, and they were kind of stuck. So they asked me and my wife if we wanted to take over the position, and we had like 4 months of experience, and we said yes. And then that was a big learning curve for us, but we dedicated ourselves to making this project better and run, and we stayed there for a year and a half. And that's how we got into farming, by being immersed in not only a farm but also a really cool farming community where farmers are revered, where the community makes it a point to go to the farmers market every Saturday morning. And I just felt that there was an energy there that was so positive and so strong that it convinced me to become an organic grower myself. And that's how we started.
Okay, so...
Well, I could go on and say we came back to Quebec and lived in a teepee for 2 years, and then bought a rabbit farm that we converted into a house and all of that. And then we bought land that was 10 acres with 2 acre that could be farmed. And that's the story of how our systems came to be, because we had limited land, and so we had to make do, and we found all sorts of ways to optimize our production to make it more productive. And and then eventually I wrote a book about it, and then it became a really popular book.
Okay, well, do you want to tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, more about what?
I don't know, maybe some of the things you're doing to optimize, or about the different things in your book, or
Okay, so when we bought the farm, we had visited farmers in Cuba because we lived in a teepee. We made a big mistake early on. We were quite young. We had seen a young couple in New Mexico. They were living with their kids, farming, and living in a teepee on rented land, and we thought that was really romantic. Mm-hmm. And so we came back to Quebec, you know, and we put a teepee on rented land and started to, you know, put a greenhouse and started to have a little market garden there. And but, you know, a teepee in Quebec is, you know, it's minus 25 this morning where I live.
So I'm in Montana, and I actually teach on the Blackfoot Reservation, where there's, I mean, nobody's actually living in a teepee here, but, and I stayed in a teepee once, and the lady I stayed with actually had it lined with herbs, so it was pretty nice. But yeah, a teepee in Quebec, I could see in the cold, yep.
So we would take our winters off, and one of our winter we went to Cuba, and then we met a lot of growers there that were farming very differently, because when the Soviet Union fell apart, the Cuban people didn't have any access to fossil fuel anymore. So they didn't have fuel to put in tractors, and they didn't have any herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, because these are all petroleum-based products. So they had to reinvent their whole farming for it to be 100% organic. And with vegetable production, they came up with this system of permanent raised beds that were contoured by cement slabs, and it was really densely planted and seeded. And for us, that was very influential, because you'd see acres and acres and acres of these permanent raised beds, and it was all farmed without a tractor. And that was what we were wanting to, you know, I've never been excited about tractors and garages and machines. And I like plants. I like ecology. And I like the business side of having a farm. But for me, the tractors were not never. And so we were looking at that. And then we came back to Quebec. And because we had bought such a small piece of land, 2 acres is not a lot to run a farm and get 2 salaries from it. We built permanent beds on almost every square inch of the farm. And we didn't leave space for tractors to turn at the end of the row. So we bluntly decided that we wouldn't have a tractor, and that everything would be hand cultivated. But by having the beds being permanent, we don't need to make the beds every year. They're just there. And to make it really simple to understand, most of the gardeners out there use techniques that we kind of scaled up and made a big garden, like a 1.5 acre garden. And then we found better tools. We bought a walk behind tractor from BCS, and power harrows and flail mowers and rotary plows, all tools that perhaps some of your listeners don't know about. Wheel hoes, shuffle hoes, better cedars that come from Korea, all sorts of tools and equipment that made our life better, because we were going faster at doing all these chores. And using black tarps to solarize and create seed beds without tilling or plowing, all sorts of strategies. And we just put everything together into a system that eventually made us really efficient and really productive. And that's how we've been able to generate, you know, good incomes from our operation ever since.
Awesome. Yep. I know I hadn't heard of a lot of the things in your book. And so it really helped to watch that video. And that little, is it the cedar that uses like a hand drill or something in there that's turning?
Yeah, there's a couple. There, the tilter is powered by a hand drill, and that creates seed beds. So it's like a mini, mini, mini rototiller, but it only cultivates on an inch. And it firms and it levels and it mixes the amendment on your seedbed, so it creates perfect silt so that you can go with your cedar. So that's one tool. And another tool is the quick cut harvester, which you harvest sallow mix with. It's also powered by a hand battery drill. And this one, it's just like a blade. It's 20 inch wide, and it's a little blade that just is actioned by the drill, and then you just go and you scoop up your salad mix. Instead of doing it with scissors or with knives, it goes about 10 times faster. And you know, I, like you said, I think if your listeners go to my website, themarketgardener.com, they can see a section with tools, and they'll see all sorts of tools that are all hand, they're all hand tools, and simple but quite sophisticated in their usage. And that's interesting.
Excellent. Well, I'm like an efficiency expert, or I always try to be super efficient. So I think, and I think that's a key. Like, so my listeners know my husband's really the gardener, and I almost always have a full-time job. So, doing anything in the garden that saves time is a big thing. And I think a lot of my listeners are like that. And just any kind of garden, you want to be able to be the most productive you can be, because it's a lot of work. And looking at your farm, I was like, wow, that's really a lot of work. I don't think I could ever do that much work. My husband probably could, and maybe he'd have to get some helpers. That's definitely over my head. But anyway, so
I just a few words about work. I just want to say, when you're working growing vegetable for your community, And you have recognizance about it, and then you have people tell you that when they do their prayers before eating their meal, they thank you.
Aww.
You get such important feedback that, that hard work is really worth it. And it is hard work, but I just feel that what we're doing is important, and that's the future that we want to see, is to have more people growing people growing with care by people who care, And so hard work is good.
You're right. That's for sure. And it is a lot of hard work. I mean, I just looking at your farm, I was like, oh my goodness, look at all of that they're doing now. So now, how big is your place now? And have you added animals? Is that what I saw?
No, you probably saw pictures of another farm that I started 2 years ago. And that's a whole other story, but it's an experimental farm that a very wealthy business person is helping fund for the province of Quebec, and we're trying to put together all sorts of alternative farming propositions into one place, and trying to see if we can recreate farms like they were before, where there was animals, there was vegetables, and most often there was a kitchen also, and to try to see if we can fine-tune all of that to create a template or farms of the future that would be more organic, more holistic. And it's a pretty, pretty awesome, pretty crazy project. It's called La Ferme des Quatre Temps. And people, if they're interested, they can hook up on my Instagram account, and they'll see pictures of what's going on there. It's just off the chart.
Okay. Well, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year then?
What did grow well? I was excited about my beets this year because I was transplanting them. And I had a program where every 2 weeks I would transplant new beets. And I would have three different beets, boom, and then I would mix all my seeds together, and then I would start my seed trays, and then we would go out and transplant these beets, and we would get really nice round beets, for sure, guaranteed, and we did that for 25 weeks, and it was awesome. And it's funny how beets they're making a comeback. I don't know if it's because everybody used to eat them from cans, but they're sweet and they're flavorful, and in many instances, you don't even need to cook them. They're so tender and beautiful and colorful, and I think they make us happy. So that was one of the crops that I was glad about.
So transplanting beets, so you're not direct seeding them?
Yeah.
So you're starting them in flats and then putting them in the ground?
Yeah.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, in 128, in this 128 seed trays. The reason why we do this is because, you know, when you direct seed, sometimes you don't get full germination in the field, mm-hmm. and then it creates holes. And so I wanted to have like perfect densities. And also, we do a lot of successions in on the farm. So we have one crop that is followed by the other, that is followed by the other. Mm-hmm. And even in our northern climate, we'll have up to three crops per bed per year. And so, you know, something's going to be growing in the field. Let's say I have salads that are there. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be harvesting the salads, boom, boom, boom. And then the next day I'm planting baby beets. And so that 3 weeks that the beets had to be inside the nursery, it's like 3 weeks that I gain in my season.
Oh.
So that's why I do that. Yeah.
Okay. How about, is there something you're excited to do different next year or that you're going to try that's new?
I'm going to try, I'm going to try a technique that perhaps your listeners will know about or appreciate. I'm going to try to set up my carrots so that I never weed them.
And how's that going to work?
Okay, so you prepare your bed, and I'm going to broad fork the beds, making sure that there's deep, loose soil in about 10 inch. That's what the broad fork will do. And then I'm going to put my organic amendment, compost and blood meal or whatever. And then I'm going to use Pilter or a power harrow on my BCS or a wheel hoe to incorporate all of that. But what I'm going to do is that I'm going to leave 1 inch of compost on the top. And I'm not going to mix it into the soil. So all of my bed will be covered by 1 inch of compost. And the compost that we use on the farm is compost that we buy from compost geeks that have big machines, turners. You know, it could come from a municipality. And it's compost that doesn't have any weed seeds because it was well composted and it was brought to the right temperatures and it was turned at the right time. And so it doesn't have any weed seeds. And so by putting 1 inch layer, and then I'm going to seed over that, I'm guaranteed almost that I won't have any weeds coming up from the ground because there's a layer. There's an organic mulch, which is the compost, that is providing a layer. And the trick to get that to work is to make sure that you're watering at least 3 times a day, 10, 15 minutes, making sure that your bed always stays moist. And that's the trick that I'm going to work on this year.
Wow, I love that. And I wonder if heads are spinning like mine is thinking, maybe there could be a business making compost, because if you're buying compost, and that's like one thing we struggle with here in Montana. And there is a guy I just talked to in like Michigan or Minnesota, I can't remember. And he said they have like an abundance of soil and compost and mulch and things. But like where we are, that's always one of our toughest things is to find good soil and find compost. I go crazy because I'm a teacher and here at the school, they throw so much food in the garbage and I just want to be like, you're just throwing that money away. I'm working on trying to figure out how to get that cafeteria to start saving all that food. But, cool. Well, people are going to like that idea of weed-free carrots.
Yeah.
And then...
I have a lot of these tricks, by the way.
Yeah, one of the things I read about was that when you plant things close enough together, the greens kind of make like a canopy, and that helps prevent weeds.
Yeah, that's the biointensive techniques that we're using. It's simple. Like, by spacing everything closer together, what happens is that eventually the leaves will touch one another and that creates a canopy, and the canopy shades out the sunlight, and so the weeds don't grow, and then it also retains the moisture. This is really good for all of the biological life that's inside the soil. And if you pay attention to soil structure, And i.e. if you don't plow or don't rotor till and you create soil that has real good natural tilth and depth, you can have these crops being really close to one another but have their rooting systems really shoot down. And so that's the key. To get a good canopy, there's all sorts of benefits to that, but you need to take good care of having a good soil structure. And that's one reason why on our farm we don't use a rotor tiller. Because when you use a rotor tiller, you assume that you're creating perfect conditions because, you know, you have full tilt and the soil is really loose and you can stick your whole hand into it. And especially men. Men really like to till, and it's just they have this impression that it's, you know, things are happening, we're producing good ground. But what happens is that all of the agglomerates, all of how your soil is structured and bound together, you pulverize these agglomerates into finer particles because of the tilling. It's like putting something in a blender, you know. Mm-hmm. So at first glance, everything is loose. If you come back a week or two later, you see that your soil starts to compress because there's nothing holding it together anymore. And so if you do this once a year, it's not such a big issue. But if you're gardening for profit and you're using your rotor tiller 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times in a year, you're destroying your soil structure every time. And you're not allowing the natural process of having earthworms and spiders and critters do the work for you because you're destroying their habitat every time. And so we've moved away from using the tiller, and we've adopted all sorts of different tools that allow it to cultivate the surface of the ground, like first inch, and tools like the broad fork, which allow us to go deeper, but without disturbing the ecology, without being a problem for the earthworms. Actually, earthworms are the best teachers. Follow the path of the earthworm, and you'll be successful. That's how I see it.
I like that. All right. So the question that just keeps going over in my head, though, if your plants are two together, is it not going to stunt their growth? Like, are they still going to grow the right? They must, because you're doing it. But I don't know why that question just keeps going.
All right. So the answer to that question has to do with soil structure. Because if you have soil that has layers or hard pans or whatever, the root system is always... The root system of a crop will always be looking for the path of the least resistance. And so as soon as it hits something that is hard going down, it's going to go sideways. And so if you are ganging all your crops together really close and you don't have really deep, loose soil, then you'll have crops that will compete with one another for nutrients and for water. And so the trick is really to make sure that your soil is really loose and deep. And that's why the broad fork is such an important tool when we're talking about biologically intensive systems. And that's why you can't be relying only on the rotor tiller for such a system.
Okay. And that broad fork...
Make sense?
It does make sense. It makes a lot of sense to me, especially because, like, my husband and I met planting trees on the Forest Service. And, like, people probably don't know, but there's, like, inspectors that go around. Like, our crew had our own inspector, and then the Forest Service would have an inspector, and they would actually, like, go dig up your trees. And if they found too many, they called them J-roots, where the roots were bending.
Yeah, I remember that.
You had to you would have to go back and replant the unit. And so... you never wanted to do that. So that was like trying to get those hodads down in the ground sometimes, and the rocky soil was hard.
When I was at university, I would raise my money tree planting in British Columbia. So G-roots, I know about that. The checkers would come and say, oh, no, you're not getting paid for that block. And I was like, oh, boy.
I think the only reason they let me stay, I never was able to make quota. I couldn't plant a lot of trees, but at least I never had any J roots because I would make sure at least my holes were deep. My husband, on the other hand, his nickname was Seldom Seen because he was like one of the fastest punters on the crew. But I think he planted probably pretty good trees too. I don't know. Okay, so do you want to tell us about something that maybe didn't work so well this season? That what didn't come out maybe the way you wanted?
One thing that didn't work as well as I wanted was we were doing potatoes, which I've never really done before. In my 15 years of growing crops, I've never really focused on potatoes because it's hard for me to get a better price than another bigger conventional grower at farmer's market when I bring my potatoes, because they all look alike, you know. And my neighbor has a mechanical transplanter, a mechanical harvester, a brushing machine, and he's so much more efficient than me at growing potatoes that I've just kind of like decided that I wouldn't grow it. But this year I tried it.
Okay.
And I dug a big furrow, and then I sprouted my potatoes, and then I put the potatoes in the furrow, and then I closed the furrow, and then I put straw over it. And I was expecting big things, and I got a pretty small harvest of potatoes that were good, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't nothing spectacular. And so now I need to research what should I do to make sure that when I put potatoes in the ground, I only get, I not only get like abundance of potatoes, I get potatoes that are like super healthy and incredible. I need to learn how to do that.
Okay. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. Laying the foundation. Unlike a mixed border or showy flower bed that functions to provide a pretty and perfect display, a cutting garden's primary job is to produce a bounty of cut blooms all season long. While a cutting patch is beautiful in its own right, the flowers that fill there are to be harvested, not left on the plants for garden decoration. This can take some getting used to because, as gardeners, we've been conditioned to resist the urge to clip from our blooming plants and instead leave them to put on a show outdoors. But once you experience the pleasure of harvesting armloads of flowers right outside your door, your approach to growing them will quickly change. This is the introduction to Aaron Bazinkian's Floret Farms Cut Flower Garden Book, Grow, Harvest, and Arrange Stunning Seasonal Blooms. And you can get this or any other book that's been recommended on our show by going to theorganicgardenerpodcast.com, just www.organicgardenerpodcast.com, click on the recommended books, and not only will it take you to, you can pick out any of the books that have been recommended, but they'll all link to Amazon, and we will get just a tiny little something, but it sure would help support the show. Hey, green future growers. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener Podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get Enter to get listening to your first audiobook today. And now let's get to the root of things. Okay, so this is the part where I'll ask you if you're, we're going to get to the root of things. It's kind of like my version of a lightning round where they're just quicker questions and just, so do you have a least favorite activity? Is there something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
In the garden?
Yeah.
Well,
it doesn't have to be the garden, maybe in the business part of it.
Oh, I hate accounting. All the admin stuff, all the paperwork, especially from government when they ask me to fill this form and that form and all, everything that doesn't generate revenues or production, I hate. Like, when they ask me to talk about what we did and blah, 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 and I'm like, oh, no, I'm doing something now and tomorrow and after. So, like, I know some people really like sitting down and doing the accounting, all of that. I don't particularly like that. And I'm not a big fan of getting back with emails also. I have too much of them now. So I like to be outside, and I like to be not bothered. Like when I can be not bothered for like 2 or 3 hours, I love that. It's like, wow.
The price of fame. Okay, so on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do?
I really like cultivating with the hose in the garden. And I really like setting out the plants and preparing the seed beds, all neat and all good. And I also like to go to farmer's market. And I meet people, they're excited, I'm proud of what I'm bringing. There's a good energy, I talk to everyone. It's also a high demand, high energy day because we have so many customers and, you know, we're counting cash, we're telling stories, we're putting veggies in a box. It's very dynamic, and then it just feels good because that's when I feel that we're changing the system, because we're actually converting everything that we've been doing in the week into something that's going people's house. And so I like that part a lot.
Nice. That's good to hear, because for me, that's always been a challenge. And maybe that's because, you know, we haven't had much to take to market, but that, like, you know, the sales part always makes me nervous. So, and we're still, like, my husband and I, we're very, very new. Like, we haven't really started to try to sell anything yet. So, good to know. How about, what's the best?
Yeah, well, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just about to say, you know, you should read the Market Gardener, and or I don't want to be just plugging my stuff, but it's really cool because there's a buddy of mine that made an audio version of the book. So now you can be cultivating in your garden and you know, with your iPhone, listen to whatever, how I do beets and how I do carrots and how I do stuff. And it just, if there's one thing I've learned, it's like, it's hard work to be a market gardener, but it's all about how you're doing it. Like, there's always better ways to optimize every step. It's like when you're a tree planter. And I don't know if you remember that, but there were people that were planting a lot more trees in the same amount of time in the same landscape, and they were just more efficient at it. And so that's really what I've been working on. Find all those tricks, tools, techniques that allow us to make a good go at this.
I was totally inspired by your book. I read it I read it when I bought it, and then I've been studying it all week. And I've been thinking of, like, because my challenge episode has been one of my biggest, most downloaded episodes, but then I didn't have very many people sign up for my challenge my first year, and I've been trying to figure out what would be a good challenge for 2017. And I was thinking maybe just going to the farmer's market each week and just, like, showing up there no matter what we have and just talking to people. I was really inspired by your book.
That's super cool.
So.
Yeah, why not? You know, why not? Even if you make $100, $200, whatever, it doesn't matter, especially if your husband has a good job, then, then, you know, it's just, why not? I think we should have more people. I keep saying this, we need to replace mass production with production by the masses. And so it needs to happen.
Yeah. So what's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
I think one of the best ones was to read Elliot Coleman's The New Organic Grower when I was starting out. Famous, you know, I assume that most of your listeners know who Elliot is. The book, The New Organic Grower, was the first gardening, farming book that I read. And I probably read it 50 times when I was young, because I was really trying to figure out how to do this. And it's been a real inspiration for me. And it probably laid out pretty much everything that I've been doing, because I've been following in Elliot's footsteps. And because I just believe that when you want to be successful at something, you need to follow people that are doing it successfully. And so I would say that reading The New Organic Grower was, I remember the person that told me about it. That was like 17 years ago. He said, yeah, his name was Norbert. He was a German guy. and he was a handyman. He was going from farm to farm fixing stuff for people for free in exchange for room and board. And he said, "Read The New Organic Grower. That's the book to read." I was like, "Okay." And then I bought the book, and it just kind of changed my life.
And now you're changing all of our lives with your book. And you should be proud to promote your book. You can say it over and over on my podcast all you want. Because I totally encourage people to read it. It was like one of the first books I bought, like, you know, because I'm going to ask you if you have a book to recommend. And, like, you know, I ask all my listeners. And it was, you know, so I certainly can't afford to buy all of them. But it was one of the first ones. And my husband just poured right through it. And that's always a good sign when he does that and has been trying to implement. Our big thing was, like, we just dug a well 2 years ago. Up until then, we had very, very limited water. Like, for the first 6 years of our life, we had to haul water. We had no running water in our house. And then he would just garden. And then we dug a shallow well. And then 2 years ago, we finally dug a real well. So that's part of why we haven't really tried to sell anything. And then a couple of years ago, I tried, like, I want to be the flower farmer. Like, I see that you recommend Lynn Bazinski's book, which I'm going to have to get, her market farmer book. I have her flower farmer book. And I tried to grow sunflowers, and I thought growing 750 sunflowers was, like, this huge thing. And then by the end of the summer, I realized I would have to grow, like, 750 sunflowers a week for a long time to make enough flowers to grow, to go to market. And then I think I pretty much decided, yeah, I'm just going to try to grow them for bird seed. And what I really want to do is just paint the flowers. But so what's your favorite tool? Do you have if you had to move and can only take one tool with you, what could you not live without? If you had to start all over, what's the one tool you would take with you? Your broad fork?
Well, yeah, I think the broad fork is definitely a tool that I really like. I also like the hose, all the shoveling hose. I really like them. The wheel hoe, I like. I kind of like, you know, I did a DVD called the Market Gardener's Toolbox.
Oh.
And toolkit, and yeah, you guys should check it out. We filmed 2 hours of all the tools that I use, how to use them, and can I say that I like the toolbox in totality? Like, I like having all of them.
Okay. Perfect. And I like in your book how you talk about, it's, you know, you talk about, like, some of the tools, it's better to invest in a high quality tool. Other tools, it's not as big of a deal if you buy a used one to keep your costs low. And you talk about the ones that would be good to, like, if you're starting out, you want to definitely try to get, you talk about which tools it's better to start out with right away. You don't want to waste too much time. Does that make sense?
Yep, it does. Hey, you talked to me about books and flowers, and I would recommend one book that is coming out in March. And,
okay.
Florets Farms Cut Flower Garden. The woman's name is Erin Benzakin. She runs a Floret Flowers farm.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a game changer with regards to cut flower. It's a really awesome book. I've read it because they've asked me to write a blurb about it.
Oh.
And I've learned so much in that little book. And it's a beautiful book. And Erin's website is awesome. And she's an awesome, awesome flower grower. And your listeners should check her out.
Excellent. Yep, she's been recommended,
yep.
And fingers crossed, she's going to do an interview with me. I spoke with her assistant or secretary, and she hasn't set down a date for sure, but she wanted to have a date close to the book. I think she said it's coming out March 7th, if I remember right. So,
well, when you do talk to her, tell her I say hi, and I highly recommend her work. I think it's an awesome book.
Okay. I will. Yeah, I'm super excited. I had a guest, Julio Flort, I can't remember how to say his name, but he's close to me down in Bozeman, and he's a flower farmer, and he went to one of her workshops last year, and just he raved about her. And I have a friend who actually sold them some aprons, is where I very first heard about Florette's Farm. So I've been following their blog for a while now. Yep. Excellent recommendation. I'll tell her, she'll be so excited. No, did you add, did you recently add flowers to your CSA? Did I see that on your website?
Well, no, yes and no. I'm kind of playing around with it, but I have a friend, her name is Chloe, and she's now a flower farmer, and I look at everything that she's doing, and I understand that there's a next level, and before I commit to that, I need to make more time to really learn how to do it well, because I don't like doing things half-assed, and mm-hmm. so I'm going to wait on that till I have more time to really plunge into that and learn how to do it well.
Okay, that's great advice. For people, yeah. I think to think about, you know, focusing on what it's interesting because the guy who runs my podcast, you've said a lot of things he says, like he has this acronym for focus, follow one course until success before you move on to something else.
Oh.
Stay, you know, niche down, stay Beautiful. In what you're doing. And then the other thing he always talks about is finding a mentor, find somebody else who's successful, and go speak to them like you were talking about Olya Coleman and his book and looking. So how about a favorite recipe from the garden? What's your favorite thing to eat from your garden?
Oh, well, you know, it's simple. I eat about a pound of salad mix a day. Like, oh. I don't know if I'm a cow or something like that, but I just, like, I eat a pound of salad mix a day, and I love it, and I love salad greens. Like, I just love them. I like growing them. I like eating them. I like looking at them. I like selling them. I'm a big passionate about mesclun and mesclun mixes and all of that. And in some restaurants, when I'm traveling, sometimes it's not always good eateries where I am, unfortunately. Sometimes I'll order something, and I'll specifically say, without any vegetables, please. Like, serve me anything else than vegetables. Because I'm so disappointed in many instances. Because I eat, like, the best veggies in the world. It's fresh and harvested and juicy and good. And when I'm served veggies that are not like that, I'm kind of a snob now. I'm a snob with veggies. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a good thing to be. One of my goals, I went to Paris last February for the first time ever. It was so exciting. And I just love their arugula salad, and they have like the little mini arugula, and they serve like the first meal I got the first day I was there, like you can't check into your room, you know, till the late afternoon. So I just had to take off right out of the plane and go walk around. And so I went and I ordered breakfast, and it was so weird to get eggs with arugula salad, but it was so delicious. And I think I grew some more arugula last summer, but that's going to be one of the things I'm going to focus on this summer too. I love salad too. I always tell people I think I'm a rabbit in a past life or something. I'm part rabbit.
Arugula, good trick for arugula.
Oh,
there cool. is a tool that is does Johnny's Selected Seeds, the good, super good seed company from Maine. Mm-hmm. They sell a tool. It's a seeder, and that seeder is called a 4-row pinpoint seeder. And it's a great tool to seed arugula because arugula is a really tiny seed and you want to have your rows really close to one another. And then you can use the same technique that I talked about, laying out compost, it doesn't have any weed seeds, laying an inch of that, and then having, you know, we grow on 30-inch bed systems, and you can have up to 12 rows on 30-inch of that arugula. And because you're planting on compost, it doesn't have any weed seeds, then you won't have any weeds, and you'll have plenty of it.
Okay.
Suggestion.
Excellent. Well, I'll take all the suggestions I can get. I'm not sure we're ready to get into such a big bet. Like for me, like last year, I planted a tub of arugula, like just a small round tub. But I'm sure other listeners who are bigger, you know, growing for you know, a bigger, I was thinking after I read your book, like my husband and I, we should just focus, like you said, your first year you guys were determined to do 30 CSA shares. Like I think if my husband and I just focus on trying to do 4 CSA shares would be big for us. Like his goal has always been to just grow enough food for the two of us and just so we don't have to buy any produce or really like supplement our produce. So we'll see what happens. And he actually, that's going to be his job this year, is his full time. I'm the one that goes to gets the regular paycheck. And he's going to focus on growing the garden. So if he grows it, I think I'll commit to going to market. My other thing is, like, I had somebody who suggested, talked about what makes a good CSA, you know, qualifications for somebody like to join a CSA. And I was like, I don't think I'd be a good CSA person because I don't like to do anything on a regular basis. And that's what going to be one of my hard things, especially because I teach full time. And so summer's like my time off, and to like have to commit to being somewhere the same time every single week. But
I hear you.
I'm going to try it. How about a favorite internet resource? And you can certainly say your website.
That's a good question. I think internet is kind of awesome in a way and confusing in another way, because there's a lot of people out there giving a lot of opinion on a lot of stuff that they don't know about. And I think it's easy sometimes to get lost. So to get good references, so I like your question a lot. I don't know what to answer you. I've been kind of not disconnected, but there's a Facebook group called Successful Market Gardening, and I think there's around 700 people on that group, and that's been interesting because when I go, I see people posting pictures of what they're doing, asking questions. And since there's a lot of people in the group, there's a lot of feedback and there's a lot of different perspectives on how to do things. So obviously, you know, I'm interested in farming and gardening and organic stuff when I go on the web. But yeah, I think that's one site, Facebook group, the Market Gardening Success Group.
Nice. I love Facebook, and I love Facebook groups. I think that's a wonderful answer. And, you know, the nice thing, like you said, about it is you can get direct feedback. And that's how I met Julio that I was telling you about before that went to the florets thing. Because it's just nice to see what other people are doing, and it's inspiring, and if you have a question. And there's another website you might like. There's one, like an insect identification site. Oh, well, you know what you said in your book? Was you're getting an email from somebody that warns you about, like, an insects that are, like, in your area?
Yeah, that is super cool, and that's the extension agents. And they have all sorts of scouters that are out there reporting on where the insects are at, different places, different regions, and then they set out an email. And what's cool about that, in that email, they also give you solutions about how to tackle problems organically, and that's a pretty positive thing. But that's in French, and that's for growers in Quebec. So I'm sure you guys should find something like that in Montana.
Yeah, and if not, maybe people will think about starting something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. How about a favorite book? Is it the Elliot Coleman book, or do you have a different book that you want to recommend, or?
I think I would recommend The Market Garden. I think it's
excellent.
Pretty good. And if anything, I've been reading kind of other stuff. There's one book out there also. There's this guy called Ben Hartman. He wrote a book called The Lean Farm.
Oh.
And he describes all the steps on his farm. But what's interesting is that he was influenced by lean management strategies, which comes from Japan, and it's just about looking at the motions of everything that you do and trying the shortcut to make things to optimize. And it's really interesting in the context of a small organic farm to look at it, all the processes like that. So Ben Hartman's book is probably the one that I enjoyed the most. And my favorite author is Joel Salatin.
Oh, excellent.
You know who Joel Salatin is, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Joel Salatin is one of my heroes. I've met him many times, and I read his books, and I just love how he writes, giving lots of good technical insights, but it's in his voices. When I read his book, I can hear him, and he gives all sorts of nice anecdotes, and I just love his style. And he wrote a new book about pigs and Christian. He's a Christian, mm-hmm. and he talks about the pigness of pigs and how Christians should have morality around how to raise animals. And it's just an awesome perspective on all of that. No, so Joel South.
Awesome. All right, cool. I'm glad I asked. Okay, so I do kind of ask a question. I mean, I know we've talked a lot, but like, since you have a business, do you have any advice for listeners, like on how to like sell extra produce or get started in the industry if they've never started before?
I think the trick is to work at least 1 year on a small organic farm.
Nice.
And to know if you're cut out for it, if you can handle the big days, if you like it. You know, some people like it in their mind, but when it's time to be, because being a farmer, being a market gardener is also about committing to long days of just doing it. You know, you can't just put it off and say, well, it's going to happen by itself. Everything that we sell, we need to grow, and everything that we grow, we need to plant, and everything that we plant, we need to water. And there's no automation. And so, yeah, that's the advice, is to work one full year on a small organic farm, and then start your own little project with 5, 10 member CSA, 15, and then evolve from there. Because the first few years, you obviously make a lot of mistakes, and those mistakes are important, because you need to learn from them. You need to make them, and the sooner the better, because that's how you become a better grower. And so I think you start on somebody else's farm, and then start a little project. You make mistakes, and eventually, after a couple of years, you have a good idea of how you want to do things, and then you set it up really nice, and then you thrive for a long time.
Nice. So in your book, you said something about like interns are good and having people who come and volunteer is good, but you would prefer a trained person. Do you want to speak about that at all?
Yeah, well, it might be personal, but I, over the years, I've had about 100 people come at my farm. Mm-hmm. I've had awesome, amazing, beautiful people. I've had people that are not so awesome and not so, well, they might be beautiful, but not so, you know, pleasant. And
you've probably also had people like me who have to be taught everything. Because it said something about like things that might seem obvious to you are not so obvious to me. I could totally see me making the mistakes, you know, that somebody else might be like, what are you doing? And like pulling it. My husband even laughed at me the year before, he had planted me all these echinaceas. And when I went to weed the bed, he's like, you pulled up all the echinaceas.
Well, that's the kind of thing that happens when you have people that are not. And to be honest, it's like, if I have somebody that doesn't know anything, the time it takes me to teach two people, like, I could do the work probably of four people during that time. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really helping me out. Like, what helps me is when I don't need to be doing it. That helps me. And so now what I'm doing is I'm taking people on. I'm showing them how to do everything. I'm giving them a lot of leeway for them to kind of experiment and feel how to do things. And then I circle back all the time, making sure that it's done how I want it and that they understand. And then when that's pretty well done, I give more leeway, and then I circle back every week, and then every month, and then every year. Because I now have a lot of people who want to stay longer on the farm. That's a positive thing.
Yeah, I bet. And then do you have people that just come visit to just check it out? Like, I was thinking, I'm going to tell my mom, let's go visit this place.
Every day, there's somebody pulling up on the farm. I don't want to say it's annoying, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
These are all super happy people that are that have been touched by my work, and I appreciate the fact that they come down to tell me. But you know, sometimes we're eating dinner and there's people in the windows and they're like, oh, this is them. Okay. So I would say we are probably going to have open days, and you should, if people are interested, they should come on the open days.
Excellent. Okay. Ready for my final question? It's kind of a doozy.
Shoot.
If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
I think we need to have, I think we have a broken food system that creates environmental disasters everywhere it's going, and create food that is not traditional anymore. And I think we need to replace that by hordes of young people starting farms. And so that's my cause. And if some of your listeners want to support that, there's many ways. Go to the farmers market and help young people get starting in farming, because it's hard for them, because the economics don't work for young farmers. It's hard to acquire land because it's super expensive, and yet people are used to not paying a lot for what they eat. And so it creates this imbalance. And so, yeah, but the young farmer coalitions that are out there, they have all my support, and hope some of your listeners will join in that. And that changes that the change that we're trying to see happen is really a big, big change.
And what's that quote on your website again? You said it before, but about the masses.
Yeah, replacing mass production with production by the masses, and providing good quality of life to people that are living on the farm, and being outside, working with ecology on a daily basis, providing nutritional value, food, like I said to you, food made with care by people who care. And that's really what we need to see happen.
Beautiful. All right. So do you want to tell us, like, you're on a tour right now. Like, did you tell me you're in Missouri? And I think I saw you're actually going to Joyce Pinson in Kentucky. And do you want to tell people a little bit about where they could actually hear you in person?
Mm-hmm. If they go on my website, they'll see a link to all the places that I'm talking. I'm not giving that many talks because I did it a lot, and I have two young kids, and I want to spend as much time with them as possible. But I'll be in Missouri this weekend in St. Joseph at the Great Plains Growers Conference, and then I'm going to New Jersey on the East Coast, and then I'm coming back in Kentucky later in April.
And are you going to Italy?
I'm also going to Italy, and that's fun. People want to come and hear me out in Italy. I heard that they have great pastas and pizza there.
I'm thinking there's a guy from Montana who might be there. I don't know, but he grows this Kamut wheat. It's like an ancient organic wheat. This guy, Bob Quinn, and I know he told me that he goes to Italy every year to a conference. So I'm curious if that's the conference he goes to. So
I would also love to be invited to go to Montana.
Oh, really? Okay, I'll work on that. Because, you know, I'm right on, like, the edge of Glacier National Park. So
I'd love to go to Montana.
Aw, all right. Well, we'll get you here. We're having a big seed thing in April. Last year, we were expecting 350 people, and 1,500 people showed up. 500 people showed up, were like through the door before it even opened, because we had 500 flyers, and they were all gone. And it started at 10 o'clock, and they were all gone by 10 o'clock. It was a super just filled. So, all right, we'll work on getting you. And the other place you might like to go to is the Aero Conference in October. I don't know. We'll have to, I'll, I'll, I'll talk to some people and see what we can do, because we would love to have you come here. I know that. Okay, just do you want to tell people your website one more time, how they can find you? And
They can find me on themarketgardener.com, and from there, there's all sorts of different things that they might be interested in. And again, I'm just inviting all the home gardeners to be happy, and I think it's super cool to be growing food. And if they don't have enough in their garden, I hope that they can go out and support some local growers out there that are trying to make it happen for themselves and for their community. So, that's it.
Thank you so, so much for sharing with us today. And just, we all appreciate what you're doing and how you're changing our world and just changing our future. And you're just an awesome guy. You and your wife, because I know she works super hard with you.
Hey, I appreciate it a lot. And I need to head out. This has been going super fast.
Oh, sorry. Hey, Green Future Growers. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener Podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And it will link right to the show notes and all that we've talked about on today's show. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.